is Clancy a Muslim? I'm an alcoholic. Again, some of you must be getting tired of my voice. I've been talking incessantly today. But this is the blow-off, so it'll be all right. I'm glad to be here tonight. I wanted to thank the committee for inviting me. I really had a wonderful... you're leaving, Reggie? I guess you can hear the tape later. If anybody isn't comfortably sit, there's rows of empty seats up here. It's really a good job, Jeanette. When I came here, I really was... You never know what you're going to find. And I got off the airplane in Boston yesterday, and Jeanette was there, and her acolytes, Amanda and Kathy, and your heart kind of sinks when you see a bunch of girls meet you, because you know that you're going to have to carry your own bags. But these girls outdid themselves. They showed up with one of these airport carts. Put it on here. And away we went, and we had a good time. We had a nice drive back from Boston, and we stopped and saw the Plymouth Rock. Had a good time at the Plymouth Rock, and Amanda and I were under some pressure because we really were looking more for a bathroom. Well, that's the Plymouth Rock, eh? Well, is there a place behind it there? Yeah. But it was wonderful. We had a lot of laughs. We had a lot of fun. We got here, and I've been treated very well since I've been here. I'm glad to see so many people I've known before, a lot of old friends and some new friends, and see my friends from New York who've come in, and these boobs from New Hampshire and Western Massachusetts. You can't hurt their feelings. They don't understand what I'm saying. And a couple of people used to be members of our group in Los Angeles and are living here now. Pasha. And I see a lot of people, but I'm really pleased by this get-together, because I think any time a viable new pocket of enthusiasm opens up in this little conference is a good thing, because it gets people together. I think I forgot to mention it. I'm sure you already know. I was talking in the traditions about this first big meeting, where they're going to have one meeting and get people together so they can see each other. And it went off so well that they said, we should do this again someday. And they decided, well, we probably won't be ready for 5 years yet. So let's do it 5 years from now. And that became the first international convention. And it's been held every 5 years since then. That was the start of an effort to get AAs together. And I know that they've had some difficulties in getting this convention started, because in areas where there's not conventions, it's always a difficulty, or get-togethers or roundups or whatever you call it. Because there's always people there who don't quite know the drill of what AA is about. And they always seem to have the same criticism. It's against the traditions to pay to bring speakers in. You're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to have people from your own group. And that is said all over the country, which is ridiculous, of course, because, you know, if it's against the traditions, Bill Wilson didn't know it, because he was brought into speak, and other people were, and have been as long as he's been in existence. The operative tradition here is every group ought to be self-supporting, which means you pay the speaker's expenses to come in. You can't ask him to support your group by paying his own expenses. In other words, you do that if you want a convention, you bring a speaker in. In case you don't know, no speaker ever gets paid. I never get paid, nor would I ever accept a penny for it, because that would be a terrible thing. But I accepted plane fare and a room, because otherwise I wouldn't be able to do it. Don't be able to do it on a continuing basis. And they talk about, well, it's a bunch of AA big shots. I don't... That may be, I can see how that, I used to feel that way when I was new about these well-known speakers. But you know, there's nothing can be done about that. The best known speaker I knew was Chuck Chamberlain, and he was the most humble man I ever knew. And people say, well, they're all fanatics, they're going out to speak all the time. But I look at him, and look at the people criticizing him, and he was always more comfortable than they were. And there was a moral there, I just couldn't make it out. I'm working on it, though, day and night. And there's always, you know, you can't charge for AA. You're not charging for AA. You're charging for the expenses to bring in speakers that you're going to come and hear. That's all. Nobody makes any money out of this. If there's any money left over, I would hope, as it does in any well-run organization, Some would maybe put aside for seed money for next year, and the rest gets donated to the offices. That's all. It's just a way to get people together. The only convention that I know that does not pay the speaker's expenses is the International Convention. And the reason they don't is because you already have to be registered before they ask you. So it's kind of a funny little thing. But anyway, so it isn't. This is not a violation of the traditions. This is an enhancement of the traditions. In fact, the people who are here this weekend are, it's sad to say it, but I'm sure know much more about the traditions than all the people who are sitting around here on the outskirts complaining about it. Because that's what A is about, is understanding and realizing we're not so different. And when you got not much going for you, it's easy to criticize. There's a theory behind that, you know. Since I can't rise, if I pull them down, it'll look like I'm rising. And that's the theory of most of criticism, bigotry, most everything. But anyway, I wanted to get that off my chest, so in case, and I hope they have a success. I looked at the speakers next year, and I'm glad they're having my favorite speaker, Peggy. No, the speakers next year are going to be very good. You'll enjoy them very much, Frank Jones, and Peggy, whose husband was supposed to be here this year, but he just earlier this week, they discovered a blocked artery, and Friday morning he had a double bypass, and he's doing very well, Dick Martin, and he was a taper. And everything, AA just seems to flourish and continue. And it's an amazing thing. I never started off, I think tonight, here I'm an old timer. I'm the oldest timer in this room by over 10 years, and I just don't feel that way. I feel young and vital most of the time. This young lady back there was 29 years. You have 29 years? I'm going to tell you something that you won't have a chance to hear much around here. This may be the only time you'll hear it for a long time. It's nice to see you newer people staying active. But I didn't really ever think I would be like this. I had a lot of difficulties in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous because, as we talked about earlier today, I mean, I never could feel it. I couldn't understand it. And I came from a nice home up in Wisconsin, a Christian, Norwegian, Lutheran home. And I grew up and I was kind of I was okay, but I was a lot of, kind of, I don't know, discomfort. A lot of kids have that. There's nothing, you know. But I was in third grade or so, I could read fast, and they didn't have any advanced courses in, so they just shoved you ahead in school till you get up to your reading level, which unfortunately puts you at a deficiency in your physical level. So I always had to show off after that to prove I was something, I guess, and looking back. And when I was about 12, 11 or 12, I was still a straight A student in school and doing well, but my parents got divorced, which, you know, is no big deal. Seems like more than most marriages get divorced. But I had lived such a protected life in this church, I had never seen a divorce. I don't know if I'd ever heard of a divorce. Because, you know, nobody, Norwegian Lutheran, ever have divorces, not in our family. And they got divorced, and if I knew then what I know now, I would have realized there's something wrong. Because I have never having seen a divorce, I instinctively did the worst possible thing that a child of divorce can do. So I wasn't even missing the beat. I began playing them against each other to avoid discipline and structure. When my mother would get on my case, I'd run to my father and tell him stories about her. And when my father got my case, I'd run to my mother and tell her stories about him. And they both got my case, I'd go to my grandmother. And I outsmarted them again and again and again. And I outsmarted them so much by the time I was 15, I was flunking out of school. And I just, unhappy and dissatisfied, and just played victim as much as I could. And the Second World War started, briefly before that, and I thought, everybody's going off to war. I thought, that's what I'll do. One day I told my mother I was going to Superior, Wisconsin to visit my aunt. She packed my little bag and gave me bus fare, and I went to hitchhike to San Francisco. I had no idea where the hell I was going. I knew it was San Francisco. But a guy gave me a ride to Minneapolis, and I tried to hitchhike from there, and I never hitchhiked before. I didn't know what to do. Some guy stops and says, where are you going, kid? I said, San Francisco. He says, so am I. Hop in. And away we went. And he's in the Navy, going back to his ship, and it didn't seem like anything to me, you know. We stopped at night. There weren't motels there, but there were trailer courts along the road. He'd buy me a bed, rent me a bed, you know, and bought my meals and listened to my drivel all the way. Must have just kept him awake anyway. And I didn't see anything uncommon about it. I just thought, that's the way it is when you hitchhike. You tell people where you want to go and they take you there. That's no big deal. And we got to San Francisco and he pointed out to me that I probably would not be able to get in the Marine Corps because I was about this high and I had pimples on all over my face and even more immature than I am now, if you can imagine such a thing. And so he said, maybe you can get in the merchant marine. They're crying for guys in the merchant marine. I go up and try to join the merchant marine. He told me how to go to the Coast Guard office in San Francisco. And your husband was not in at that time, was he? No. And I went up there and my little back said, I want to be in the merchant marine. He said, tell him you're 16. Don't tell him you're 15. You'll never get in. So he'd be fill out an application. I fill out an application. Said, you're only 15, kid. You're only 16. We'll have to have your parents' permission. So I took the paper and went around the block, got my parents' permission. and they were really crying for merchant seamen then, you know, because they just gave me seamen's papers right there to be followed up by criminals. Gave me temporary merchant seamen's papers and sent me down to the Embarcadero to the on Montgomery Street to the National Maritime Union, had me sign up for some union dues, and the guy gave me a ride over to the Embarcadero where there's a bunch of ships, the one was just leaving, there was short a guy, and he threw me on that ship, and away we went to the South Pacific. And it was fun for a while, you know. Went by Treasure Island, guy says, that's where the World's Fair was last year. Went by Alcatraz. That's Alcatraz. Seen pictures of that. Went under the Golden Gate Bridge. Seen pictures of that. But the damn ship just kept going. And pretty soon the earth was going out of sight, you know. And I think I had an intuitive feeling that I'd made the first in an endless series of career mistakes. And I sidled up to some guy with gold on his cap and said, I really appreciate this opportunity, but I should be getting back. We have a big English test on here, don't we? He said, get to your forecastle. I didn't know what a forecastle was, but it sounded ominous to me, I'll tell you. And it turns out, if you've been on a ship, forecastles are where the crew sleep, area where the crew sleep. And I finally found out I was supposed to go in a room or a cabin, as they call them. And there were three of the worst type of people in there that of any small 15-year-old frightened dumbbell could ever be with. And these kind of people are called men. And they looked at me. And I could see there was some tension in the earth. I didn't know why then. I realize now. Because the four of us made up a single deck watch. There were three deck watches. Now we were four to each watch. And when they saw me, they realized they were each going to be there doing their work and mine for the rest of that trip. But all I realized, there was a little tension in the room, so I told them a couple little jokes that used to go very well in study hall, you know. And they didn't. Why don't you shut your goddamn mouth and get in your bunk? And I lay in that bunk, and the ship was moving. I'd never feed. I never smelled the ocean. It had a funny smell. And I'd never been anywhere, done anything. I hadn't even been to Milwaukee yet. And here I was on a ship in the South Pacific. And these guys got talking, and I'll tell you, I was just shocked, because whatever my faults were, I'm still a Norwegian Lutheran, and I'm basically a decent person. We have two main rules in the Norwegian Lutheran Church. You don't sin, and you don't monkey around with Catholics. And seems reasonable if you want to go to heaven. And these guys got talking, and I couldn't believe my ears. They were sinners, just terrible sinners. They were talking about what they'd been doing in San Francisco while the ship had been in port for 4 or 5 days. And they had been doing terrible things, just terrible things with girls. Just, ew, I couldn't believe it. And I realized they all got black hair. Catholics. I'd never seen any close up, but I'd heard about it. They looked like it. And even at the age of 15, I don't give the wrong impression, even at the age of 15 in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, I'd had sex. But I'd been apprehensive, and I'd been afraid, and I'd been alone. And these guys were doing it with other people. And I just felt terrible. I just never felt so bad, I don't guess. But, you know, as the days went by, I developed a role on that ship, a needed role that many military or semi-military organizations have. And that is the organizational fool, you know, that you just use to fool, you know. Hey, kid, go down the engine room. Thomas, we need a left-handed wrench. Hey, kid, go over the bridge. Tell the captain who needs an elbow grease. Hey, kid, one day the guy says, hey, kid, you want a drink of whiskey? They had whiskey in their sea bags, but I drew the line at that because I'm a Norwegian. And I just hated them doing that to me. I just, how dare they do that? And I promised both my mother and grandmother I wouldn't drink, and I don't drink whiskey. I would never drink whiskey. I'd sip beer when I was a boy. Everybody in Wisconsin drinks a little beer, but, you know, just sip here and there. But to drink whiskey, that's crossing the line. I could just feel my pimples standing up, you know. And he says, you think you're man enough for a little snort? And he put it under my nose. And I was just about to shriek at him, how dare you put that bottle under my nose, you big Catholic bum. Don't you ever do that to me again. I was about to tell him that, and I heard a voice say, goddamn right. And I realized I'm a little weak under pressure, too. So I had my first drink out of the first bottle of whiskey I was ever close to. I'd never been close to a bottle of whiskey. Protected life. And it burned my mouth and burned my throat and burned my stomach and burned my throat and burned my mouth and burned his shirt, last I felt. Yeah, yeah. I'll get the bottle after all, son of a bitch. God, I don't know any feeling then or now that's worse than public humiliation. Public humiliation, I don't know, to this day, I would, you know, that's the worst thing that can happen, just being publicly laughed at. I don't think any people like us, maybe nobody, well, people like us don't like it at all. I thought later, I wish I had just some tool to smash their face, but I didn't dare hit them, you know, wasn't big enough. I thought later, there's one thing I might have done. I'm glad I didn't think of it at the time. I'd have been thrown overboard, but it would give me a moment's satisfaction. Hey, buddy. Yeah. Take that. Just give him one in the old eye. But all the way across the Central Pacific, when nobody was looking, I stuck in that guy's sea bag every day and took a drink of whiskey. And I hated it, and it made me puke. It was just terrible. I'd wipe it up. But I wanted so desperately those people to think I was some kind of a man. It had nothing to do with it. I didn't know what an erroneous objection I was making. But all the way, I'd wipe it up so they wouldn't know it. And God, I just hated it. And we were coming into Pearl Harbor, and you're still digging up ships off the bottom. And I was still a dumb kid, but they were up looking. I was down there, and remember that, the day before my 16th birthday. I took a drink of that terrible crap, and it burned my mouth, and burned my throat, and burned my stomach, and stayed there. And I didn't throw up. And then turned out I couldn't breathe. God, why do people drink it? Oh, and all of a sudden, something strange happened. All of a sudden, I found myself feeling significantly better. I felt warm and tingly. I just fell away. And I realized that's why people drink whiskey. I didn't think anything about it. You know, no big breakthrough. I've always admired people I hear in AA who have insights and understanding of each step of the way. I heard a guy say, when I held that drink down, I knew I'd gone into a new garden of experience. And there'd be many flowers and fruits to be savored in the coming years until I left that garden and came to this wonderful program and found you wonderful people. I just get sick with envy when I hear that sort of thing. I never knew that. All I discovered, if you don't puke and you can breathe, it makes you feel better. That's all I learned. I learned to smoke on that ship. I didn't know anybody in my family who smoked, but they smoked. So I smoked and puked and smoked and puked and smoked. One day I smoked and didn't puke, and I smoked 2.5 or 3 packs a day, every day for the next 40-odd years. And I must say, I was telling someone earlier today, it still hurts me I had to stop because of a throat condition. They took out part of my vocal cords. They got me in a weak spot. Can't you take my arms or legs instead? You take my leg, I wouldn't kick. I don't know. I've never said that before. I'll never say it again. I just try to amuse me, and sometimes I fail. But, you know, it hurts me to this day the way they treat smokers around the world. Because most of 20 years ago, everybody in AA smoked. Maybe two or three people didn't, and nobody talked to them. You know, don't smoke. Why don't you go home, you wussy? You know. And now nobody. Oh, you smoke? That's really. Hear people say, I smoked cigarettes for 50 years. Then they quit smoking for 2 weeks. And someone's lit a cigarette within a mile of here. That's making you crazy. That secondhand smoke scam is about as bad as they come. It's worse than individual smoke. Not at all. Less 20 times as much problems in smoking as there is in secondhand smoke. But they don't like, anyway, I don't want to get into that. But I want to say something here. I don't know if I've ever said this from the podium. Maybe I don't think so. Something to the smokers here. Because the non-smokers are getting more and more aggressive. And they stick their face in your face. Why do you smoke? Don't you realize what you're doing? And the second you're just... I'm going to give you an answer to use. Not to any of these people. But when you go return to your home and some dumbbell prying nosy old bag sticks your face in your face and say, why do you smoke? I'm going to give you an answer, and I'll guarantee you she will never ask you again why you smoke. I developed the last 2 years of my smoking. It was just wonderful. You say, why do you smoke? Well, I have a feeling that one of these days they'll find a market for phlegm and I'll be rich. And they will say, oh, how gross. But they will never ask you again why you smoke. You can use it in my name. But I learned about sex, how to lust effectively on that ship. I learned all sorts of things. And later on, I got another ship. And when I was 17, I went in the Navy finally. And I got the Navy. And at the end of the war, I was in the Naval Hospital up in Northern California. Being sewed together. And at the end of the war, of course, they passed around all, gray ladies come in, passed around all the tests they have left over and try to get rid of stuff. And I've always been a reader, so I do well on tests. Not much on life, but tests I'm good on. And they came back in a couple weeks. Oh, Clancy, we're so proud. You got the highest grade they'd ever had in this hospital zone. And I didn't know what that meant. Maybe I'll get a prize. But they gave me a certificate, which was the equivalency of a high school diploma issued by the Armed Forces Institute. Where I said, what a downer. This isn't much. But I look back now, that really changed my life significantly. I don't know what I would have done if I would have done that. Because even then, I was a smart aleck. And I might just as well have made all the answers wrong just to be cute. Just to be cute. Yeah, just to be a smart aleck. But anyway, I got this certificate, and what it enabled me to do, when I went back to Eau Claire, Wisconsin after the war, I didn't have to start my junior year of high school, which they didn't want me to do if I hadn't taken that test. I never would have done that. I don't know what would have become of me. I don't know what I'd have done. But instead, I was able to go to college. I went to college, the beginning class of veterans, 1946, and was the bizarre year of all-American education. About a year and a half ago, we had at the University of Wisconsin, we had a 50th anniversary of the beginning class of 1946, and all these people, a lot of them showed up. You think, why would you have an anniversary of a beginning class? That's for graduation. I'll tell you why. Because that was a bizarre class. You have to be old to realize that. For the first and last time in the history of American education, millions of people got out of the service at once, and they all had the GI Bill. And many of them didn't know what to do, so they went to college where they could make some dough. So the colleges were just flooded. They rented barracks and built temporary buildings and just all sorts of things. And really, you know, you get a freshman English class, and there'd be some hard-bitten old Marine sergeant, about 45 years old, sitting next to some little girl just out of high school. Were you in the war? Yeah, you put out? Yeah, really bizarre. Kind of fun to see all these people. They all got terribly old. I'm so glad I didn't. I stayed the same and they got old. Funny thing. But it's good to see him. But anyway, I went to college. I found some things I could do, and I won some trophies for that university. I did well, and I met this girl in college, and I'd met a girl, never met a girl close up quite like her. She's very attractive. She had a lovely figure, but she had coal black hair, something you never see in the Norwegian Lutheran Church. Just exotic, looks like a, and coal black eyes. And, oh, and she won my heart, and all parts of me, hopefully. And I fell in lust. Anyway, she won my heart. After she had me hooked, she notified me, I'm a Catholic. And I tried to break free from her evil spell, but I couldn't. So we got married. My grandmother had a case of the vapors for 3 years. Oh, Sonny, why do you do things like that? Yeah. And so I went out in the world. I became a sports writer, newspaper sports writer, which is to this day my favorite job I ever had. But then my wife began to manifest the bad things that many times happen when you've married a good Catholic girl. Nobody ever tells you it's going to happen. They never tell little Lutheran boys, if you marry a good Catholic girl, you are about to have a big family. Whether you plan on one or budget one, nobody cares. You're just going to have it. And I began my supplementary career as a national distributor of small Catholics. Just boom, 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 boom. It adds a little pressure on you, I'll tell you that. I remember talking to her and saying, can't we use birth control? No. I never was much for coitus interruptus either, I'll tell you that. But you'll go back to biting your nails then if you quit. Anyway. Oh, the hell is that, another kid? I thought about that later. I thought, you know, I didn't know what I'd have done if she had said yes. Because it's hard for young people to realize this stuff. But in those days, nobody ever talked. I never heard the word condom ever. The closest I ever hear, you'd hear really bad, tough guys say, you know what I got? I got a rubber. Oh. And this was among worldly wise people. I could swear and drink and curse and attempt to do all sorts of terrible things, but I didn't want to hear about that kind of talk. And if you ever wanted to get what I'll call condoms, they sound a little more euphemistic that way, you'd have to, even the bad guys, you'd hire some renegade who was just terrible and had no, you give him money to do it. Even the tough guys are good, and they'd be ill at ease. So. Give me a pack of cigarettes.
And some condoms.
Oh, Jesus. Things have changed over the years. Now kids, at least the drugstore near my house, they come in and say, hey, give me some condoms.
And some cigarettes.
Yeah, it's really terrible. So I had more children, I had to get better jobs, and I got to find in advertising and advertising agencies and public relations firms, and I had some victories, and all these years I drank. Because drinking was something I just stumbled along the way, like kids find out. I didn't think anything about it. Alcohol is the best friend I've ever had. That sounds terrible, perhaps, if you're kind of new. Or new again. I don't like to embarrass you. Yeah, 17 straight years of being one day sober, isn't that just a bit much? But yeah. But alcohol always did for me. It's the best friend I ever had. Friends come and go, love comes and goes. Cities come and go, jobs come and go, but a few drinks really makes the difference. You know, I don't know the better way to describe it, that I discovered in those years, I didn't think about it, but it's really true, of myself, I never seem to feel like I'm quite enough. I don't know why. I don't know what's missing in me, but I know something is missing in me. I don't know what it is, but other people can recognize something is missing in me. and they get a bit close to me, they don't seem to like me much anymore. So much of my life has been spent in pretending to be something I'm not, so they won't know I'm not enough. And but when I have a few drinks, I temporarily become more than enough. Hey, baby. What a great feeling after being a wussy all day. Just of myself, I seem to be bothered by a lot of fear. Not only fear of pain and things like that, but fear of exposure. Fear that people are going to realize I'm nothing and they're going to ridicule me and hurt me. And oh, God. When I have a few drinks, I become relatively fearless. I fight cops. I jump off balconies to swimming pools. Don't have a swimming pool? Shit, I'll jump on your lawn. Makes you look the name. Takes a person like me who's... When I'm feeling inadequate, I'm afraid. I'm so absolutely... I hate being rejected. I hate getting my feelings hurt. Just, I'd almost rather die than asking my friends, because I know they'll say, you know, hate to ask my wife to dance, because if she says, no, not now. When I drink, it's all different. I must have said it 1,000 times, but I don't still know a better example of it. Sure, it's happened to a lot of guys in this room, maybe sitting at night in a bar, late at night, having a few drinks, thinking how they're screwing around on a work. Brown nosers are getting ahead, men of integrity are being held back. And suddenly you notice a miracle slowly happen in front of your eyes. Some old beast gradually becomes beautiful. I might sidle over such an old queen at closing time and imply there will be delights beyond her comprehension if she'd like to join me in the old Chevy. If she was a no, God, if I were sober, I would just cut my wrist right there. Just, ooh. But I wouldn't be there asking the question if I was sober. I wouldn't do such a thing. When I've had a few drinks, I don't feel rejected. I feel sorry for her. Too bad, bitch, don't come begging tomorrow. That's why I drink. I drink because I'm kind of a sensitive guy and a misunderstood guy, and sometimes I drink too much, and then well-meaning people say, oh, you had a drinking problem. Some people sent me to my first AA meeting a long time ago. I mean, nobody knew what AA was hardly. In this little town, there are a few people in AA, and they said, go over there. Maybe you can cut down your drinking, because sometimes you have a tendency to become bizarre. So I went to my first meeting in 1949. That's a long time ago. Most of you little snots weren't even born. We love you. And I went to AA, and it was nice, but a bunch of old fools in their 30s and 40s and 50s and gray-haired old goofs, and I'm sure I felt the same way that some young people feel in AA now. You sit there and these old goofs say things like, I stayed drunk for 20 years. One day I walked through that door. They told me to put the plug in the jug, and I did. And I've just never felt so goddamn wonderful. You feel like saying, why didn't you tell your face? Yeah. I was around AA for a while, and I got the message, but it really didn't really apply to me, because my case was a little bit different. And for the next few years, I went to AA off and on in various cities where I worked, when the heat would be on, and AA wasn't very well known. You could always hold off an employer, a family counselor, but say, I'm going to go to AA, and it's fine. But I knew it had no deep-seated purpose for me, so I went to psychoanalysis. I spent thousands of dollars in psychoanalysis, and I found new ways in which I'd been hurt I hadn't even realized. I've been victimized by a lot of things that I don't want to tell you about, because I don't want tears to roll down your cheeks. But I read books. I did a lot of things. But the number one thing that always helped me through my emotional problems was a few drinks. And I got to find a way to have it. And I'd get up for period in the 50s there seems to me that my life consisted of finding myself in this new town with a rewritten resume, going into an agency with my samples, my writing samples and my resume, and saying, you know, I was in that last town, but Christ, there are a bunch of squares. You understand good writing. Look at this. Here's my resume. I've worked for the big people. I'm doing good. And they give you a job. And I'd do pretty well, and I'd bring my family in, and the heat would start. And then pretty soon, I'd, as must always happen, the drinking would increase a little bit, the frustrations, and the people getting on me, and I'd pretty soon get angry, and my feelings hurt, and I'd either explode and quit, or I'd get drunk too long, and they'd fire me, and I'd be in a new town with that resume, and do this again and again. Every time my family would join us, me 9 months and 10 seconds later, another Catholic would hit the street and just, I'm going to go, oh, no, no. And one day, I went up and down and up and down and up and down. One time I went down and didn't go back up. And I couldn't believe it. I didn't go back up. I had no reason not to go back up because I had as much skill and ability. And all of a sudden, it went in a matter of a little weeks. My family, my wife took the children and left me. That had never happened before. And I couldn't get a job. And I lost my home. And I had to get out of Texas. I knew that because I was in deep trouble. And I found myself in El Paso trying to, where I had been in the faculty there, and they tried to get some dough. And I wound up in, next thing I knew, I was in Phoenix, Arizona. And I got into beef on the street corner with some guy, and he put me in jail overnight. He was a cop. Most of my jails have always been overnight, just because I got such smart, nasty mouth. I put the son of a bitch in jail overnight, let him cool off, you know. And in the middle of the night, I was sick, and I went to the toilet and threw up. It turned out to be not the toilet, it was a guy's bed, actually. And he came back and found me asleep by his bed, covered with vomit. He just, damn you, drunken. And he kicked my front teeth out. I've said that story many, many times. And what I used to say, and I forget to say it sometimes, I want to tell you, it isn't as sad as it sounds. Not my real teeth. I'd lost my real teeth playing ball in college. Hollering mine for a pop-up. My pain. Some guy's shoulder, my teeth, I should see my teeth in his shoulder after I left. But I had a good set of, a very excellent partial that gave me a wonderful smile, and he kicked that out. And I couldn't replace it. And the next thing I knew, I was in Los Angeles. And I hung around Los Angeles for a while, and it's terrible. And one night I went to the AA club that I had gone to a couple times, because AA is the only place you can hang out when you're feeling like that. I didn't know where I was, but the guy said, here's $2 or $3, stay away from here. And I went across the street and had a couple of drinks and caught a bus downtown. I didn't know where I was, but I knew how to get off the bus. And that's where the all-night theaters are, and I slept in an all-night theater all night. And I don't know if you ever slept in an all-night theater, but they don't really run all night. They run to about 5 in the morning. Then they wake you up. Come on, get out of here. Come on, move it. And I know of no worse feeling I've ever had than coming out of an all-night theater into a cold, rainy, gray morning, and not a friendly direction. Not a friendly direction anywhere. No place to go. And the guy said, right, come on, let's go over and sell a pint of blood. I said, okay. So we went up to East 4th Street, and there was a blood bank up there. They used to call it the dance hall. Because people, before it opened, you get their cord at 6 in the morning, open at 6, there'd be about 20 guys out in front going to... just sick and desperate. And they took a drop of my blood and wouldn't let me sell my blood because it didn't have enough iron. And I walked back to the Midnight Mission, some scurrilous old mission in the 4th of Los Angeles. And I went in there and I said, hey, I need some breakfast. I'm sick. So you missed breakfast. It's all over. I said, God damn it. You know, I'm not a bum. I am. And I said, come on. And he said, shut up, you. And I took a swing at somebody and two guys just came over and threw me out. And stay out of here, you bum. And I tried to explain to him, I'm not a bum. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I helped write, the old L.C. Delmer ads for the Borden Company, were running that very week in Life and Time and Saturday Evening Post. I've had my picture in the New York Times for my achievements. How many people do you know have had their picture in the New York Times for achievement? But it's hard to explain these things in midair. And I stood outside that stinking old mission in the cold, drizzly rain. We've had some days like that recently in Los Angeles. That always reminds me, just very poignant. I feel like standing outside just to recapture that hopelessness. And I felt terrible. I remember thinking, maybe, I don't know if I thought it, maybe I felt, I don't know. But thinking that, God, any minute now, my wife is going to come and wake me up and get me to work. This she's going to say, you really had a bad dream. You hollered in your sleep again. And, boy, what a dream this has been. But it wasn't a dream. I stood there and I can't, this can't be happening to me with my education and my background, my ability. If some old guy would have walked over to me that morning and said, you know, Slim, you're getting down to your death. You're down about 125 pounds. You've lost your wife and children. You'll never see them again. You've lost your career. Once upon a time they called you a boy genius, and now you can't even get a job washing dishes. You're a nothing. You've lost your home. You had a couple of nice homes. You lost them. They're gone forever. You've lost your front teeth. Even you get on your feet, you can't get a job because you got no teeth. You can't go any place without front teeth and get a job of any decency. You've lost all your clothes. Somewhere between Dallas and here in the last month, it's all gone. All your clothes, all you got left is what you got on, and they're wet and torn and dirty. You're an only child, and your mother is not allowed to accept phone calls from you, because your stepfather is so sick of watching you call her and build her hopes up to get some money and then crush her heart with your performances again. He would rather have her think you were dead than the way you are. Now, you've been in and out of AA for many years now. In and out, you think you know all about AA. Why, for God's sakes, did you just go back to AA, admit you're an alcoholic, and do something with your life before you die? If some old guy would come over to me that morning and said that, and if I were in a mood to be honest, which I may or not have been, most people in this room know that when you're desperate, you're not concerned about honesty, you're concerned about how can I get out of this, or what can I do to beat it. But if I were in a mood to be honest, I'd have to say to that guy, pal, it isn't the way it looks. I'm not an alcoholic. Jesus, I wish I were. I wish I were. It'd make my life so much simpler. But I'll admit there's something terribly wrong with me. I've known that since I was a little boy. And I've always disguised it. But it isn't, my problem is not alcohol. If it were, boy, I'd have been home free a long time ago. I can't explain to you. But my problem is that sometimes it's just, I can't stand it. I'm not an alcoholic. He said, well, prove you're not an alcoholic. I wouldn't be able to do that because I wouldn't have had the objectivity to be able to stand back and examine myself. So I probably would have done what frightened people like me do, which is take refuge behind bluster and say things like, ah, get out of my face! Scray you, son of a bitch! Leave me alone! Because I wouldn't have known the right answer. I know the right answer now, and I've known it for a long time. I've seen it happen in myself, and I've watched it in many, many other people come through the door. The reason I absolutely knew and was willing to bet my life on the fact that I wasn't an alcoholic, it wasn't due to any metaphysical insight or wisdom or great psychological knowledge. It was a very pragmatic thing. Because I knew what an alcoholic was, and I wasn't that. That's all there was to it. So that begs the question, what's an alcoholic? Well, everybody knows what an alcoholic is. People upstairs in the hall where we are drinking. I mean, they're having a drinking party last night. They know what an alcoholic is. People driving by in the street. Alcoholics are people, and I knew this because I've gone to meeting after meeting for years all over the country. Alcoholics are people. There are some people who don't seem to handle alcohol very well, and eventually they get drinking kind of bad. They don't handle it very well, and pretty soon their lives get screwed up, and their emotions get very painful. And they get driven to some place like AA, and AA sobers them up and clean up their act, and then they feel better after that. And I know that's true because I heard those same thing in Chicago and New York and San Francisco and Minneapolis, place where I went to meetings when the heat was on. And the people were different and the specifics were different. But it's always the same story. I drank a lot, I came to AA, and now I feel better. Isn't that true? And that's why I always knew I wasn't an alcoholic. I drank like an alcoholic. I compare, can swap drinking stories with anybody. You want to talk about going to jail? I know about going to jail. I know about all sorts of things. But the one thing I could never quite get over was this. I now realize, I didn't know what it was then, I couldn't put my finger, I now realize what it was. Unlike alcoholics, the thing that makes me different is, it is when I get sober and clean up my act, that's when my life gets painful. And that's when my emotions get out of whack. And eventually, the longer I try to be good, the worse it gets. It's almost as though there's some kind of a big spring inside of me. And when I stay sober, people start compressing it. And just pressure and irritability and crossness and self-pity and resentment. I have to put up with this crap and utter the... And eventually, I can't stand it. And I have a few drinks. I don't drink because I'm a drinker. I drink because that's the only thing I know that releases that spring fast. Then sometimes I drink too much. And well-meaning people say, oh, you seem to have an alcohol problem. You ought to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And the correct answer is, of course, when you're in that situation, gee, thanks for the advice. But inside of you, a voice just wants to shriek, but you don't understand. My case is different somehow. I don't know why, but nobody understands. But I stood at that street corner, nobody came over and talked to me. I just stood there in the rain. And I thought, I get out of this rain, I think I'm going to die. I remember where that club was on Wilshire and Fairfax, wherever the hell that was. I didn't know how to get there from where I was. And I said to the guy, well, it's Wilshire and Fairfax. He said, well, Wilshire doesn't come through. You have to walk up to Hill Street and cut over to Wilshire and then turn right and go west until you come to Fairfax. And I walked, and I was sick and walked and walked and walked. I counted that later in my car a few years later. That's 72 long blocks. That's a long walk when you're sick and desperate and hopeless and friendless and nobody can. A woman asked me one time, how could you possibly walk that far when you were so sick and desperate? And of course, the answer is quite simple. That's the only time you can. You could do it no other time. But when you're sick and desperate, you can do what you have to do because there's no alternative. And I got to that club, and then I got there, and as soon as I thought, oh man, why'd they come here? Because I'd been in there, the last time I'd been there, I'd been asked to leave, drunk and denouncing them and telling them how lucky they were to be stupid and not cursed with intelligence. And not my fault. But I went in, I had to get out of the rain, and I went in this club, and they weren't glad to see me, and I wasn't glad to see them. It was just a hideous experience. And not only was it a club, but it was full of AA fanatics. I don't know anything more tedious to an intelligent slipper than to be thrust among AA fanatics. Yeah. First things first, keep coming back. I'll tell you how you describe AA fanatics. You know, I'm not a mooch. I've never been a mooch, except when I've had to be. Well, I'm like a lion. I don't kill for sport, I kill for food. But sometimes you need help, and you have to let these simpletons know. They mean well, but they don't have sense to know anything, so you have to kind of give them an open clue. And you say things like, hi, I decided to work this program all the way now. I've come back for help, and I want to work the steps and really find a new life. I'm a little disadvantaged. I have no place to stay. And I'm cold, and I don't have any dry clothes. I'm hungry and kind of sick. But, you know, if I want to find this program and return to the God I've lost in the bottom. If I just had a place to stay and maybe something to eat and some dry clothes. And you think that... make a stone turn. Do you know what an AA fanatic say? They say, go to a lot of meetings, work the steps, it'll all work out. Of course, the answer to that is, oh, gee, sir, you're number one with me. And I hung around that damn club, and that night they had a meeting, and I ate about 4 pounds of cake just to keep my strength up, and had a terrible meeting. Some people talk about how wonderful AA was, and then I had no place to sleep that night. They closed up the club after me. Where can I sleep, sir? Says, there's an empty car down there, an old 49 Merc in the tall grass. Joe Quinn left it there last summer. It's dry. Go sleep in that. You want me to sleep in an abandoned car? Yes, pretty lucky it's there. Yeah, really. I came to that club the next morning. It was Sunday morning. Not only had the meeting, but a spiritual meeting. Jesus, I had about 4 pounds of cake, and some old fool talked about God for an hour. And that night I hung around there, still raining, and I went to another meeting, ate some more cake, and they talked about AA, and slept in that car that night, got up the next morning, hung around that club all day, went to a meeting, ate 4 pounds of cake. Just day after day, I remember thinking, maybe I'm dead. You know. Maybe this is what I get for marrying a Catholic. There is. And I have no idea then or thereafter that was my sobriety date. I wouldn't have guessed it. I had no desire to stay sober. I had no reason to stay sober. Of all the times I ever got sober, I had the least reason or desire to stay sober. I don't suppose anybody ever slipped as long as I did, and has now been sober as long as I have, who doesn't look back and think, what was different this time? What was different? I'd like to know that. That is my own information, but I'd like to be able to share it with people, because they still refer long-term slippers to me. And I get a lot of long-term slippers.
Well, see, a client says he's a crazy like you are. So
yeah. And I wish I had some way to convey to these people the ability to stay sober. When I was about 4 or 5 years sober, jump ahead a little bit, I really had caught a terrible wave of enthusiasm. And I discovered that I had done something. I could do something. I was working in a big corporation. I was doing well. But I discovered I had an ability, and people commented on it. I had a tremendous ability to talk people into sobriety, to talk them into AA, to get them here, to get them coming. And I really thought that I'd been blessed by a divine gift. And it took a while to discover, almost, but not quite, because I could not talk them into staying in AA. I could not find the words mostly to get them to stay in. And I said, "What? Why not? Why not? Jesus, it's so clear that I could." I didn't really understand the nature of it till a few years ago. I was in my backyard. I have a driveway in my backyard. And I was teaching two of my grandsons to ride a bicycle. And they could not. I put them on and they fell down. And Joe had a cut in his arm and John had a bloody nose. And we don't want to do this anymore, Grandpa. Yes, you do. You just don't know it. At the end of the day, they couldn't ride a bicycle. They were bloody, and their mother gave me a ration of crap. How can you do this? The next time we did it more surreptitiously. When nobody was home, I took them out there, and we did it again, and they fell down again. And I was really so sad. I thought, isn't that sad? I've given my life to AA, and I get blessed with two retarded grandchildren. I decided to stop helping them. After that, they did a lot better. Eventually, something happened to those little rats that happens to most everybody in this room, I'm sure. Nobody can explain how it happens, but it happens. All of a sudden, out of nowhere, you get a sense of balance. And you can now ride a bicycle. You can ride a motorcycle. Ride whatever you want for the rest of your life. But you cannot give that ability to someone for whom you would give your life. Everybody's got to get on their own on their own bicycle. And fall off, and sometimes quit, not even try. And sobriety, in a much more complex way, is exactly the same thing. Everybody somehow has got to get their own sense of balance. And how do you do it? You can't give it to anybody. It's just frustrating as it can be. I look back and I think, why did I stay sober? Why did I stay sober? Because maybe I had a deep-seated reason. I really wanted to stay sober. I must have had a deep-seated, not at all. Not at all. The one time I ever really tried to stay sober, I gave it everything I had. And I was in jail again overnight one night for a little problem. I had gotten a beef with some guy, which is all right. I've done that a lot. I know how to do that. But in the morning, they had to come down and tell me, we tried to find you last night. Your little son died, and we couldn't find you. And that just about killed me. I had a bunch of little girls and one little boy, and he died. And he was not special, but he was the only one of his kind, so he had a special interest to me. And I felt so bad about that, I couldn't stand it. I really thought I was going to go insane. I remember sitting around that weekend before the funeral, and my wife's brothers came in, and other family members, and they were all sat around the living room. And not a single word, not a negative word was ever said to me. They just all smiled and looked at me and were pleasant. I could just see their eyes, you dirty, rotten son of a bitch, look what you've done. But they just smiled. And I felt so bad when we buried that little boy and put him in the mausoleum. I put my hand in his casket surreptitiously. And I said, John Emmerslin, this will never happen to another child in this family, ever, ever. And then I went down to Texas to work. And I did pretty well. I was drinking a little bit, but I was really watching because I really had a feeling. And I had a good job, and I liked it. And pretty soon my wife and children came in, and the pressure got on a little bit. And something I never realized took my inventory years later. I did every time my family would come in, it increased the pressure, and my drinking would increase without even being aware of it. It's just more pressure. And eventually my wife had to say, remember now, you're getting to drink quite a bit. Remember what happened? I said, yeah, that's right. I'm quitting drinking. And I stopped drinking right then. And we have some new people here tonight who might not be sure of this. Can people like us stop drinking if you have a good enough reason? The answer is absolutely yes. You certainly can. For a while. But eventually it starts to get, after a while it starts to unravel just a little bit. And pretty soon you lie in bed at 2 in the morning and here come through the door, here come your old friends again. Resentment and self-pity. And feelings that nobody understands me, and it's not my fault, and they don't know, and when they come in, it isn't going to be very long now. And eventually I got so the spring was tight, boy, and I needed to drink, but I'd promised on my son's casket I couldn't drink. I didn't like my job anymore. I didn't like those people. Didn't like this town. Didn't like that wind blowing. My kids who I was doing it for, I just, noisy! Mary, take your sister, go to your room! Let Daddy alone! I'm sorry. I'll talk to you about it later. I'm sorry. Daddy doesn't feel well. I didn't know what was wrong with me. I now know what was wrong with me. That spring was just about maxed, and there was nothing I could do, and I couldn't drink. So one day my wife took the children to mass, and I pulled the car in the garage and just hooked up the hose in the exhaust pipe, turned the motor, and went to sleep and died. I didn't know anything else to do. And some neighbor was watching us through the window, I guess, and saw me go in there, heard the motor running on a summer day, late on day, and I didn't come out, and walked over, found me slumped over the wheel, apparently dead briefly, and they pulled me out of there and beat it in my chest and breathed in my mouth and rushed me to the hospital and examined me, determined I was a badly suffering mentally ill person and transferred me to a high security ward and examined me some more, came to the conclusion I was an intense schizophrenic with paranoid tendencies and committed me for an indefinite period, perhaps for the rest of my life, to the Texas State Insane Asylum in Big Spring, Texas. Now that's how I get when I stay sober, folks. You know, that's not a big goal of mine. You know, we're going to help you stay sober, boy.
Jesus.
I should say in passing, I was there about 2 weeks. I started to feel better. I was protected, I guess that's why. And I thought, what am I doing? A guy, bright guy with me with $60 a month, redneck Texas attendance. I thought I should. And I found a way to get through a door and down a corridor and through another door and across the yard. They said this was an escape-proof hospital. And I was over that fence and I was gone. But it really is an escape-proof hospital, but you don't know until you get out, because once you get out, you suddenly realize they can see you running for 3 days. Well, there goes that little Yankee sandwich now. And they snatched me back and gave me several months of electric shock treatments for that run. All the things I've just told you about that whole year, I don't remember. It never came back in my mind, but I certainly heard enough about it. I mean, I've heard from people who were there. But we had a lot of shock treatments. It really knocks out your memory for many years, and most of it comes back with the last few months. I don't remember anything. And but I know that the next year, I thought, my mind was coming back, and I was thinking, I should get out of here. You know, this is going to look bad on my resume, just year after year, this nut house. And they put it in, that year, they put it in an alcoholic ward, and they're run by a couple AA guys from that little town. And once my mind was enough, when I saw them, I knew I had them, because I know how to handle AAs. And I played that guy like a zither. And he arranged for me to be transferred to the alcoholic ward, and I told him, as though I'd never been to AA, I gave him all the right answers, how I wanted God, and I wanted to go to meetings, read the literature just fine. And in about 2 months, I was excused there, or released as a recovered alcoholic. And I never had another drink until I ran out of Thorazine. But, you know, that's how I get when I should say in passing, I've always thought I'd like to go back to Texas sometime and find that psychiatrist that diagnosed me as a schizophrenic, a dual personality. He must be about 90 now. I could move him around pretty good. Call me a dual personality, you idiot! You should lose your license! Christ, if I could have got my personalities down to 2, I'd have made it. My problem has always been this group that gathers in my head at the drop of a hat.
Let's get out of here. Don't think we can. What do you think? I'm not sure. You know.
Years ago, I used to hear people say things like, I'm not sure A is enough for me. I may need group therapy. Not me. I just go for a ride alone in my car. That's what's so good about alcohol. Alcohol reduces it to one voice. It may be a bad voice, but it's one voice.
Why don't you quit your job and punch that bastard in the face?
I didn't want to stop drinking. I had no desire to. I look back now, and I think the number one reason why I stopped, and as far as I can tell, and I've been thinking about it a lot, I was fortunate enough to be thrust into a group of AA fanatics. I wouldn't call them AA fanatics tonight. Tonight I would call them AA winners. If you're new tonight, we have a few new people here, you'll hear that phrase again and again. Stick with the winners, stick with the winners. Who are the winners? How do you know who the winners are to begin with? They don't wear a sign. You think, the people who have been sober the longest, that must be it. Sometimes they are, and sometimes they're not. I know old-timers in AA that once upon a time had AA, apparently, but they haven't got it anymore. They're just old, sour, bitter, nasty people. And I just say hello and goodbye to those kind of people. I don't have nothing to say to them. Well, who are the winners? I'll tell you who the winners are as far as I know, as far as I can tell. They're the people who came here feeling different, afraid, lonely, desperate, the way you and I have come here. And they allowed people to superimpose things over their defenses, and little by little they begin to take actions in AA, and somehow they begin to stay sober. And after they got sober, were sober a while, they are the ones sitting in these seats on a continuing basis, week after week, and they're looking for other people to come in lost and afraid and giving them their time and energy to help them. They are nearly always the activists in the group. The people who clean up afterwards, the people who make the coffee, the people who do other things, the people who go on the expeditions, other meetings, all these things. And you say, why would I want to stick with the winners? For this simple reason. As I say, winners are activists. But you don't have much going for you, and none of us have much going for you when you come to AA. I mean, we can put up big walls and pretend to be hip and slick and cool or whatever it is, but you don't come here feeling good. You feel, most of us feel like nothing. And when you feel like nothing, it is a natural tendency of the human being to blend in to the people around you, to take on their characteristics. If you're around people who are being active, you'll wind up being active even though you don't intend to or don't wish to, because they're all doing it, you know. After I'd been around that stinking club for a little while and I got to be known, I mean, I remember thinking about 7 o'clock at night, what'll I do today? Maybe I can hustle some guy for a couple bucks and go to a show. Maybe get something to eat. I don't know what I'm going to do. What did I do today? Come on, Clancy, get in the car. We're all going to the meeting. I didn't mean to go to that meeting. Come on, Clancy, we're going to help Fred move his furniture. Oh, shit. On and on and on. And little by little, I stayed sober long enough to get to the second stage, which is even more depressing. Time to get a sponsor. Get a sponsor. I've had a lot of sponsors. I don't need a sponsor. Get a sponsor. Get a sponsor. I got sponsors. Now, I see this actor come in and out of AA and the meetings there. He is a character actor in the movies. He wasn't a star, but he's always played loving uncles and loving brothers-in-law and cousins and so on. I thought, I'll ask this guy to be my sponsor. Maybe he'll take me to his front teeth, maybe a suit. I'll get out of this damn town and go somewhere I can do something. I said, Bob, will you be my sponsor? Yes, I will, son. But you want to do what I tell you now? Oh, sure, Bob. You know, he played a lot of loving roles in the movies. He should have won the Academy Award for every one of them. Because they were foreign to his nature, I'll tell you that. He turned out to be a right-wing fascist AA pig. Jesus Christ. And he just turned me every way but lucid. Like we were talking today, you know, I was saying earlier today, you know, he intimidated me. Somehow I let him intimidate me. I don't know why it was. Some instinctive, I don't know, self-flagellation, because he respected him or something. But God, he never listened to me explain anything. He just said, "Do it." I said this story, meant him, I don't know a better way to explain it. I was about 2 or 3 months sober. I was at a meeting one night, and standing in front of the podium at the coffee break, you know, having a cup of coffee. I noticed a woman in the second row, as we were looking at her. I really despised her. Her name was Mary Ellen. She was just the princess. Everybody loved Mary Ellen. She had babies, and she was the secretary of the Monday night meeting. They just all loved her. And I just despised her. I hated her. I couldn't do anything about it, but I could fantasize. I think to myself, someday I'm going to find her in a dark street, and I'm going to smash her face. I'm going to drive her nose right into her brain. Just. And I knew I couldn't really do it, but it cheered me up somehow. And I said, they're feeling good about that. Here comes my sponsor. Classy! So I want you to apologize to her. My God, he can read my mind. That must be a warlock. I said, why? He said, because last night somebody told me that you called her a bitch at the Frank Randall meeting. Well, at least he couldn't read my mind, you know. Well, Bob, you know, I don't know if you know it or not, but she really is a bitch. Why do you think she's a bitch? She told her new girl not to go to bed with me. But she's right. You won't apologize. And she could hear all this. And she's sitting there. And I thought, I would rather have needles stuck in my eyes than go over and say, I'm sorry. That I said, Bob, Jesus. He said, oh, shut up and do it. And I just told him, I said, sorry. You bitch. Oh, was it like that? I want you to go to the Central Hollywood meeting Tuesday night. Oh, Jesus, Bob. Not that meeting. It's full of crazy people, guys. Some of the men dress like women. Some of the women dress like men. There's a guy there in an A-Rod costume with a Bernice. Bela Lugosi goes to that meeting sometimes, for Christ's sake. You doze off, you'll suck blood out of your neck. I said, there's four weirdos, Bob. He said, you'll fit right in there. On and on. And he had me take action. I should say it in his defense. He also, when I did something right, once the great man gave me a pat in the back. That made me feel better. I felt like I got some advertising award. And little by little, I stayed sober. And I gave him impressive things. Like, from time to time, I had a little job I didn't do very well. I remember I was sober a few weeks, and I'd been living around that club. And I said, Bob, you know, I used to be something, really. You know that. And I'm living hand to mouth. People buy me hamburgers here and then eat a lot of cake and cookies at meetings. There's one son of a bitch that gives me an apple and I can't eat that. And I said, you know, Bob, I'm living outside in an abandoned car, Bob. That really no way for a guy trying to find a new way of life. Do you understand that? What am I going to do? And he said, get a job. I said, Jesus, Bob. Look how terrible I look. You're a terrible job. Well, I followed that direction with a great deal of zeal. I had a lot of terrible jobs. Remember, I was 6 months sober. I was hanging in. I'd been living in a little apartment with a guy, and he got tired of me because I wouldn't leave the apartment when his girlfriend came to be serviced. And I said, she's more used to the streets than I am. Let her go out in the street. Not with her. So I was back in my abandoned car. And I got a job as a dishwasher. I got fired off of that after 2 days. And I thought, I might as well die. What's the sense of dying? What's the sense of living? And I decided to walk in the ocean, a la A Star Is Born. I've always had a sense of drama. Just and I couldn't find the ocean. Now, is that a nice thing? I called up my sponsor. Bob, I lost my job. I just can't go on anymore, Bob. I was so desperate, I told him the truth. Bob, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? He says, why don't you write your damn inventory the way I told you? You had told me a week before to write my inventory. I had told him, I've taken my inventory with a psychiatrist. I don't need to take it with an out-of-work actor. What good is that, for Christ's sake? That made him testy. He was always getting testy about something. I said, my judgment, Bob, that's the last thing in the world I need. I'm so full of remorse and regret, and I've ruined so many lives. I'm just no hope. Writing an inventory can't help me in my judgment. He says, your judgment? Who cares about your judgment? You live in an abandoned car, for Christ's sake. If I wanted your judgment, I'd put the head in the back window and ask you for it. You know. But I care. You've got to surrender the judgment. That's what you got to sublimate that judgment. Sublimate. He got me so upset I came out of that floor. It's a good thing I didn't turn right. I'd have been in the ocean in three bottom. Boom, boom. And when I went back to the A Club and said, give me some paper. I don't have my inventory. I was so upset I wrote things I'd never told anybody. Terrible, nasty, petty, rotten. I wrote things that, you know, people say, that's what inventory's for. Maybe, not really, not if your case is different. But I got an inventory and I didn't feel any better. But I had kind of a good feeling. I proved it didn't help. And that cheered me up a little. And about a week later, he took me for... I was feeling bad again. He said, come on, get that in. I don't feel like doing it. No, Bob. Shut up. Get in the car. We drove from Santa Monica to Oxnard, 40 miles. He gave me a flashlight. We drove. He said, now read it. I said, Jesus, Bob. I'm not sure all of this still applies. He said, just read it. And I read these nasty, rotten things. You know, people say, well, why won't you tell those things to your psychiatrist? Because if you're paying that kind of money, you can't risk rejection. That's why. You did what, sir? Get out of my office and wash off that chair on the way. Yeah. And I just, it wasn't the big things. The big things are easy. It's the petty little chicken shit, nasty, rotten, stinking little dirty, filthy. And we got up there, and I thought he was going to make me get out of his car, but he just yawned. I've taken that trip over 200 times since then. On the driver's side, or some other boob over there with a flashlight. You know. Yeah. Let me explain this part before I read it. And I'll tell you, there's nothing ever new in a well-written inventory, in an honest inventory. It's always the same. It's always lack of self-worth, guilt, fear, and occasionally lashing out at the world that's hurt you. It comes in many sizes and colors and styles, but it's always that. Remember a few years ago, in 1 week, I heard an inventory from a daughter of the most famous, one of the most famous men of the 20th century. And a week later, from some guy who'd been born under a bridge in El Paso, never saw his father. And they had the same inventory. He was just out of the penitentiary, and she's from a penthouse. Same inventory. All different specifics. She had luxury all her life, and he just came out of the penitentiary. Same inventory. Fear. Lack of self-worth, guilt, all different things to blame. That's why AA is so effective, it seems like, over the years, because when we get to that stage, we're at the same place. And then later, I'd be make amends to my father, who I hated, and do a lot of things that I hated to do that changed my life little by little. In a little period of time, I stayed sober. And by taking actions. I remember the one thing I could not do, I could not possibly ever return to God. And he had eventually pointed out to me, AA doesn't ask you to return to God. It says you come to believe in something. Can you believe in God? And I said, no. Because if God exists, I am damned. You know, they can talk all they want about, oh no, you're grown up now, but when you've broken all 10 commandments, I remember saying when I came to AA, I've broken all 10 commandments, and you can't come back to them. It wasn't for a year or so I remembered I haven't broken all 10 commandments. I've never coveted my neighbor's manservant. Well, I said that once in West Hollywood, and the guy said, I have. But little by little, I stayed sober. By the time I was 2 years sober, I finally got a job I held as a little writer at a medical corporation. And I'd squirreled away some money. I said, Bob, I got some money. I'm going to get some front teeth. I'm going to work on it and knock them dead. He said, you got money? Send it to your kids in Dallas. I said, Jesus, Bob. They all got front teeth. They're doing all right. He said, I know, but you got a rotten father. Send him money. So I sent him the money. I went to work at that corporation. I
curved my lip like this. Most people never even knew I didn't have front teeth. I thought I'd been burned in a fire, I guess. But I went to work, and on that job, I learned the greatest spiritual lessons I've ever learned. Some of the greatest spiritual lessons I've ever learned. I learned from my sponsor and other well-meaning people. Now you talk about spiritual lessons. What are they? Meditation, prayer. They're all very nice. But they're kind of introspective things. Out there in the world is where we got to make it. You know the great lessons that saved my bacon? Do what you said you would do. Be where you said you would be when you said you would be there, or let them know you're not going to be there. Don't take out your hostility on people who can't answer back. Children, employees, waiters and waitresses. On days when you know you feel rotten, watch that stinking tongue, because you could just cut people up and never even know it, just to lash out at them when you're in a position of authority. And on and all sorts of things. And I never did any of them very well, but I was able to hold a job. By the time I was 5 years sober, I was director of advertising for that medical corporation. When I was 6 years sober, as I mentioned today, I was brought into Revell, and I created a big sweepstakes where we gave a real jet, surplus jet fighter plane to some student up in Oakland. I don't know what the little puke ever did with it. We just got our pictures. Good luck, son. Now, 7 years sober, another guy and I were brought into Hollywood, and we created something called Boss Radio. It became the number one hard rock station in the world. We all wore shiny suits, and we said things like, "What's coming on down, baby?" By the time I was 10 years sober, I was downtown doing public relations with oil companies. 15 years sober, I was a marketing director in Beverly Hills. When I was 5 years sober, the same wife and all those children heard the crinkle of green in my wallet all the way to Dallas, Texas, leaped out of their post office box, fled to my side, attached themselves to me like a group of starving chiggers. 9 months and 10 seconds later, another Catholic up the street. Boom, boom, boom. Now they're all grown up. My youngest daughter just had her birthday Thursday this week. Wednesday, 40 years old. That's kind of tough. It's hard. I'm only about 33 myself, and that's the way I feel. And that last child was a boy again, so I had my boy back. So he's been kind of nurtured, you can bet on that. But they're all grown up, and three of them are in AA, and the rest of them aren't, and the ones that need to be in AA are, and they're doing fine. They all been sober. They all got sober in 1989 for some reason. The oldest one got, and they just fell into place. And I've held the job I got now for the last 25 years. That's a pretty good run. And I live in a house out by the ocean on the west side of L.A., best part of L.A. to live in, with the weather and climate. And I live with a certain amount of dignity and peace. I want to tell this young lady, with one day sober, I hope this will help you, because I think it will make you feel better. I've got it all together, and you haven't. But I know you're happy for me. I sound terribly cruel, don't I? But she and I already have an understanding. And that's all very true. It's very accurate. I just want to take 5 minutes now. I know you folks want to dance, and I want to get back up, and maybe I can watch the Bible Hour on the table. We're just up halfway through Ezekiel. It's really getting good now. I want to just say something to her and this young man that's new over here and the two young men that are new back here. I'll give you about 5 minutes, if I may. Everything I told you up to now is true, and it's all accurate. But the one thing that I haven't explained, and you may not even think to ask, I said I was an alcoholic. When did I become an alcoholic? I wasn't an alcoholic when I drank. I wasn't an alcoholic when I got sober. When the hell did I become an alcoholic? I'll tell you. I became an alcoholic when I stayed sober a while, and I didn't think I was an alcoholic for some time. If I was an alcoholic, I was some special kind of alcoholic that these people couldn't help. Long enough to over my one defense against alcoholism was always this: but damn it, alcohol is not really my problem. Damn it, alcohol is not really my problem. And I stayed here long enough and listened to enough old fools and did things around here, and one day it started to seep into my mind. My God, that's what Alcoholics Anonymous says. Who'd have thought that?
Now, you may think, oh, of course, AA doesn't say that. Everybody knows the problem is alcohol. I can disprove that in 5 seconds. If alcohol is the problem, detoxes turn out recovered people, and they don't. Treatment centers turn out recovered people, jails, hospitals. They turn out sober people with varying amounts of information what may be wrong with them. But I'll guarantee if they be like me, and I presume like you, if you're in this room, unless something dramatic happens after that, sooner or later they must always, inexorably, eventually drink or sedate. But what's the problem if it isn't alcohol? Is it something mystic? Is it something metaphysical? We have to get some more books or videos on or something? No. Everyone in this room knows what's wrong with them, but they may not know it. They've heard the word, but they may not know what it implies. The problem here is not alcohol. It is something called alcoholism. You know, well, it's the same thing, isn't it? Alcohol, alcoholism, same thing. Not the same thing. I'll guarantee you that if you're like me, the day will come when your existence and your sanity will depend on remembering the difference. So what's the difference? Well, I could talk about that for 2 hours. I did once. In Cape Town, South Africa, and I think I created the revolts that have been going on ever since down there. But let me put it in one sentence. An alcohol problem is overcome by stopping drinking and cleaning up your act. However, in this strange, bewildering thing called alcoholism, this mind-boggling, perception-distorting, physically ruining, eventually fatal thing called alcoholism, you will discover sooner or later that stopping drinking and cleaning up your act has no significant long-term effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you can't stand it. That's what makes alcoholism fatal. Not that you can't get sober, not that you can't get shaped up, not that you can't get cleaned up, but sooner or later, sobriety becomes more painful than the memory that is associated with the relief of alcohol. That's part of it. And one other thing must be present. You must be one of the 6 or 7 or 8% of people, and nobody knows to this day why or how, who for some reason get an unnatural reaction to alcohol. And the problem with that is this. Nobody ever knows it's an unnatural reaction from alcohol because you have nothing to compare it against. It's like saying, do strawberries taste unnatural to you? I don't know. They taste like strawberries. That's all I know. Is it unnatural? I don't know what they're supposed to taste like. There are 6 or 7 or 8% who get unnatural reactions from alcohol. So the question to solve that, if you're kind of new, what are these reactions? So we know if we have them. Is it you stay drunk all the time? Your old timer say, I stayed drunk around the clock 25 years. That's podium talk. No human body can stay drunk 2 straight weeks, night and day in the laboratory. That's one of the rottenest parts about being a drinker. You keep sobering up again and again and again. Is it yak crazy? You hear these speakers say, and then I escaped from San Quentin, and then I went to the nut house and burned that down, then I raped 4 nuns, and then, oh. In my work today, I see alcoholics die, literally die, and some of them have never been crazy once. They get more and more catatonic. So what is this elusive, mystic difference? It is something that I would have never guessed on my own in 10,000 years because it's such an everyday common thing to me. Alcohol, the unnatural effect of alcohol, it must almost immediately make everything all right. That's all. What kind of an unnatural reaction is that? It's a significant one. It turns out it doesn't do that for most people. That's why they don't drink. It isn't because they're morally or spiritually superior, but they don't do it. As Carlene said today, they drink and they get warm feelings and a little fuzzy. And if they drink a little too much, they get dizzy. Then they get sick. And they will never know, I would never guess that, and they will never know what alcohol does with me. Alcohol doesn't make me sick. Alcohol almost instantly alters my perception of reality. It adds some neon lights in that stinking tunnel. It's a great, There's an old joke. I haven't even heard of it for 30 years, but it just popped in my mind. I'll tell you, only short joke. About this guy sitting in the Bowery in New York, going to commit suicide. His life is over. He got a little scrap of paper. He's writing a letter. Dear Mom and Dad, I know you tried to help me and you love me. And just then something bumped his foot, coming floating down the gutter. He picked up the bottle of wine with about a third of a bottle of wine in it and some saliva and other bad things. Well, before I go out, and if there's anything I could ever do for you, let me know. Just changes things. And if it does it for you, I'll tell you it's great. They talk all, sometimes today we get caught up in what's much more romantic to be a narcotic addict. We don't say I'm an addict. I've been working with addicts for over 25 years, as I said earlier today. And I think I know as much, I'm not an addict, but I know a lot about addiction and information and observation. And I, heroin addicts, for example, they get such euphoria, but they always overdose. Cocaine gets up there, but the side effects are always paranoia and restlessness. But alcohol puts you right where you are. And there's nothing wrong with that. It changes my, except for one thing. If it does that for you, it must almost eventually kill you. For a very simple reason. Because I use it to escape from the difficulties of reality, which makes them untaken care of and get worse. And eventually I come to depend on alcohol. And one day you can't do it. You become, so you have to get sober. Then you realize it wasn't the alcohol, it's all these damn things that are happening. So you got to drink. And then you can't just stay drinking, so you got to get sober. And you can't stay sober, so you got to drink. And people just think it's just a series of unrelated things. That's what's called alcoholism. And today in America, where there's more sobriety than any place in the history of the world, it is estimated about 95% of alcoholics still die drunk, or as a direct result of drinking. And I'm sure they all die saying the same thing, or one form or another of it. But you don't understand, I'm not really an alcoholic. My problem really wasn't alcohol. It was all these things in the real world. I just drank to get some relief and got a little out of hand, that's all. They don't realize that's the definition of alcoholism. And the reason that's important to know is that if you're kind of new, you will not sit in these meetings and learn the words and then be surprised one day you start to feel bad. That's the natural state of sober alcoholics. Growing anxiety and depression and tension and despair and self-pity and resentment. And you think, well, I'm sober, but what am I going to do? You started with this premise. You're not an A to be sober. Earlier today someone said, we're here to be sober. In a sense, but not really. Being sober, you can be sober at almost any place. In a toilet floor. Being sober is the entrance to Alcoholics Anonymous. You can't be an AA, I don't believe, unless you're sober. And there's another thing today with all the profusion of medical euphoria. It is my belief that AA does not teach me to get off alcohol. It teaches me to live in reality. But you come to AA and it's new and it's kind of fun and you meet new people and they're interested in you. Could you raise your hands, a newcomer? And after a while the novelty wears off and AA little by little gets to be a drag. And the people get to be a drag and the string is starting to squeeze up again. And oh Christ, AA doesn't work for me. I'm not sure an alcoholic anyway. Then, what you do then, you try AA. AA is a series of changed actions and surrenders of your judgment. Once upon a time in Toronto, I was talking about the steps and some old goof said, in just a sentence or two, what would you say is how people stay sober? Can you synthesize it? And it took me a long time. I finally thought of an answer. The next day I came back and told him. If I would put it in one sentence, it boils down to this. Doing things that you don't agree with. Everybody's willing to do things they agree with. It's when some old fool tells you to do something, and you know, I know you mean well, but damn it, you can't possibly know as much about me as I do, and that wouldn't work for me. And then do it anyway. That's what desperation helps you do. Desperation and being around winners who are doing it, so it makes you feel uncomfortable if you don't do it. I don't want to do it, but I want to be accepted. Okay, I'll do it. And little by little, and this has been said by our other speakers so well, the steps don't care who takes them, you just do them. And little by little, you stay sober. You don't feel wonderful. You know, you hear the speakers there in these meetings, you kind of sounds like you're saying,
well, when I was a young man, I was fine. Then I began drinking, and my life really went bad and got terrible. One day I came to this wonderful program, and since then it's been a steady upturn, and every day's a holiday, and every meal's a feast, and it's just wonderful.
That is the way it is. That's podium talk again. Life isn't like that. Most of us have this experience.
I've come here and I have a little bad luck, and oh, Jesus, I'll have to watch that next time when I move there. Oh, Christ.
I about hold my own now, I guess. And one day you're way down here and you're driven to A, and oh, I found A. Oh, thank God. A wonderful new life. And, oh, Jesus Christ. And there is no one-time surrender that I know. That's what the spiritual experience that Bill Wilson had and Chuck Chamberlain had, but nobody else I know. A one-time surrender. Most of us aren't like that. You hear old-timers say, I came here, now threw in the towel, and by God, it's been wonderful ever since. Here's what alcoholics do. I came here, and I threw in the towel, and as soon as the heat was back, I snatched that son of a bitch back. And I'm spending the rest of my natural life tearing off small strips and see if that'll set. How much more do you want, for God's sake? And you do that, and you know what A is about? It isn't to make you stay sober longer and longer. What A is about, in my opinion, is this. AA is designed, to the best of my ability to tell you, to very slowly do what alcohol used to do fast. But it's come so slowly, as Carlene says, you can't even see it happening because it's so slow. So slow. But over a period of time, I look back at what's happened to me? I can't see any particular time it happened, but today I find myself feeling like I'm enough most of the time. Sometimes I still don't feel like I'm enough, and then I have to wonder, why don't I feel like I'm enough? My God, I'm working the steps to the best of my ability, trying to help people and doing these things. And suddenly realize, no human being feels like they're enough all the time. That's part of being a human being. Nothing to do with alcoholism. The amazing thing is I feel I'm enough most of the time. A person like me who's lived with fear all my life, I do things today sometimes that people say, oh, Clancy's so fearless. I found myself a couple of times in the last few years going down alleys on Skid Row where the police declined to go down with drawn guns. And I'm down there with my mouth to pull some son of a bitch out of there. And they say, oh, and I do it. Oh, Clancy, look how fearless you are. I'm fearless. I know how to do that. That's why I'm down there. If I attempt to think I'm fearless, all I have to do is imagine myself sitting in my living room with my wife, perhaps, at an evening, and have her say, or have us hear a suspicious noise in the backyard. And I'd send her to see what it was. I'll tell you that. Because it may be a boogeyman. And everybody knows that Al-Anons are less afraid of boogeymen than AAs are, that's all. They can destroy them with their cold smile. I release you. Takes a person like me, when I look back, about two-thirds of my life was spent with my feelings hurt from one way or another. Just continual. And today I don't really have my feelings. I still have my feelings hurt once in a while, but I no longer think this is a gigantic conspiracy. It's just people that I see different. If I can see where they're coming from, I can understand why we have a conflict. Much to my surprise, I came to believe in my sponsors, my higher power. So I could accept that. Eventually came to believe in A is my higher power. One day I listened to enough of these old fools, and I heard, as I mentioned today, a guy cursed me into going home and saying a prayer. And I've prayed every day since then. Over a period of time, I've come to believe God loves me. Isn't that incredible? No more than you, no less than you. Either God loves all of us or he don't love any of us. And I remember going back to Eau Claire, Wisconsin to take my little mother to church a few years ago before she died. Sitting in that church and looking around the church and see all, I'm thinking, my God, the same God is in this church as in my meeting in West Los Angeles. And most of the people in this church don't even know what God is like because they're sitting there in fear. And they ought to just be glad that they're here where somebody loves them. And you never become perfect. The point is that if you can come to understand the nature of your disease and that recovery is possible, not more and more sober pain, but little by little an altered perception of reality, it gives you a little more motivation to keep going on days when you don't feel like it. Because there are days when you must keep going when there is no reason to keep going. There are times you must take actions that there is no possible way you can take those actions. And you do it. And that's why it's good to have someone to turn to like you. And that when you have a strong sponsor, that I had, it's a funny thing. I always think of equivalency as like a little child with his dad. And we got to hold your dad, you're not afraid of nothing. And boy, that's when you're a newcomer. And one day you get sober 2 or 3 years, you get to be like a teenager. Who was that old son of a bitch holding me back? You're not as... Then if you could survive that burst of wisdom, you get to be like an adult, like a grown-up person with his father, someone who you would cherish and respect for what he did for you. You now understand it, especially if you have children of your own. And that's the way it is with your sponsor, to cherish and respect it. He loved me when I didn't love me, and I'll always cherish that. But in the last analysis, AA is always the same. It isn't, AA is not the big book. The germ of AA is not the big book. It isn't spirituality. It isn't love. Because none of these things were much worth anything at the beginning of AA. AA tonight is exactly the same. These are all great helpers to AA. But AA is the same thing tonight in Falmouth, Massachusetts, as it was June 10th, 1935 in Akron, Ohio. One alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to help him reduce his feelings of difference at least enough so that he will begin to take actions he does not yet believe in. And when that moment comes, that's the germination, that is the inception of sobriety. And then we must cherish it and work with it and share it and be with other people going in the same direction and stay away from others. That's why they say stay away from losers, new people. Not because they're bad. Sometimes they're fun people and exotic. So how do you spot a loser? Well, I don't know, but I'll tell you one inexorable way. When you hear someone come up to you and say things like, oh, you don't have to do all that. Don't do all that crap your sponsor says. That's just nonsense. That's just finances. Because they'll kill you. And they'll go on to kill somebody else. You just, so long, pal. I'm going to stick with these people. And one day you find yourself walking with some degree of dignity in the world, and some degree of peace, and you haven't become wonderful at all. And sometimes you have cares and troubles, but there's a way out of it. And you're surrounded by people who understand you and who love you and who care for you, and you love for them. And when that day comes, you'll find it's worth everything it took. Thank you.